The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we're honored to host a conversation with Professors Jennifer S. Hirsch and Seamus Khan, co-directors of the ethnographic team of SHIFT, the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, a research project that explored sexual health and sexual assault among undergraduates. The resulting book, Sexual Citizens, A Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus, is built upon their years of research, interviews, and observation. Jennifer S. Hirsch is a professor of sociomedical sciences at Columbia University, co-director with Claude Mellon of SHIFT, and the author of A Courtship After Marriage, Sexuality and Love in Mexican Transnational Families, and The Secret, Love, Marriage, and HIV. Seamus Khan chairs Columbia's Sociology Department and edits the academic journal Public Culture. A former Time magazine columnist, he is also the author of Privilege, The Making of an Adolescent Elite at St. Paul's School. Tonight, our guests will be in conversation with Dr. Jen Ashton, chief medical correspondent for ABC News and author of a number of books, including The Self-Care Solution, A Year of Becoming Happier, Healthier, and Fitter, One Month at a Time, as well as The Affecting and Powerful Life After Suicide, Finding Courage, Comfort, and Community After Unthinkable Loss. Please join us welcoming Jennifer Hirsch, Seamus Khan, and Dr. Jennifer Ashton to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
So I'm thrilled to be here in Philadelphia with Jennifer and Seamus talking about their incredible research and this incredible book. That is my copy. It's already highlighted and underlined, so I would encourage you to get yours upstairs. If anyone tries to take this one, I will notice. I also want to, just as a disclosure before we start this incredible conversation, make sure that everyone is aware that we will be discussing potentially triggering or sensitive topics. You will hear the word penis. Don't be surprised. We don't use slang. And if that makes anyone uncomfortable, please feel free to step out for a bit if you need to. So without further ado, I want to ask you, Jennifer, to start by telling the story of how this book was born. Talk about its conception.
Without saying the word penis.
Yeah. We'll save that till the second question.
So cast your mind back to 2014. There was a lot of conversation about campus sexual assault, but the focus was really on adjudication, on he said, she said, and on how campus processes could be made more fair. And as you know, I'm in public health. Our job is to keep bad things from happening. And I thought, you know, what if we understood the social roots of this so that we could prevent it, so that there wouldn't be so many cases?
And then you talked to Seamus.
And then how much of the story do you want?
The
whole story. So I thought, okay, let's do a little bit of research on prevention. And I sidled up to the person at Columbia who was responsible for managing the institution's response. And I said, I have a little idea. And the little idea grew and grew. So I reached out to my friend Claude Ann Mellons, who's a psychologist. And we put together, and this is the great thing about working at a research university, is there is sort of one of everything. And so we put together a dream team of faculty and a giant staff, and Columbia was very generous in providing funding and created a big research project with two surveys and an ethnography, which is what you do when you spend time listening, talking to people, and living alongside them. We worked with the students and the administrators, and that was also in the course of those early months that Seamus and I, we're an arranged marriage, and so that was when we got connected to work on the ethnographic part of SHIFT.
So the book reads incredibly well, really from the first page, although the beginning of the book is difficult to read in parts because of the subject matter. But Seamus, explain a little bit more about how you actually did the study, because at times I literally have to remind myself that this represents your study, because it doesn't read like a boring scientific paper.
Sure. So the part of the research project that this book is based upon, the ethnographic portion, involved interviewing 151 students. And so we spent a couple hours with them, talking to them about their lives, sort of their ambitions, but also their experiences with sex and their experiences with sexual assault. For some of them, you know, there was so much to talk about that we ended up doing two rounds of follow-up interviews. For some of them, we spent 6 hours with them. We also hired a pretty large research team that helped us integrate into campus life. So, you know, Jennifer and I can't really hang out at a fraternity basement party without being fairly noticeable as, like, there's my sociology professor. And so we had younger-looking people who all had experience in doing the kinds of research that we do, but also with very different backgrounds. So, for example, one of them had experience with men who were often abusive in the relationships that they were in. One had experience in working with LGBTQ populations, others in doing research with people who were from minority backgrounds. And so what we did is try to give a portrait, not of sexual assault, but of sexual life of college and life of college in general. The aim of the book is really to sort of like pull back the curtain on what college life is like today. And in doing that, to sort of enmesh our accounts of sexual assault within that broader context. So rather than think about sexual assault as a distinct thing that's totally different than everything else or that can be explained in and of itself, we decided to enmesh it in the broader stories of what young people's lives are like.
And I started reading this book, I've had it now for a week, and I was looking at it through multiple different lenses. As a medical doctor, I have half my practice is under the age of 21. So the college age group is an age group that I know well in my professional life. I'm the parent of two college students. And so I have to admit that I kind of thought, like, I mean, I know what's going on. I'm hip to that. I think my kids talk to me. My patients are honest with me. And immediately as a parent, I was riveted to this. So explain a little bit about the different audiences for this book, because I think that's one of the most incredible things about it.
I mean, so I think who are our readers? All of you, but our readers are everyone who reads. I think that for students, we've had so many students, you know, text us or message us on Twitter and say, like, you saw me, right? Like, and someone even came up to me at the book signing last night, and I was telling a story about a queer young man from the Midwest who, you know, wasn't out to his family and his early sexual experiences, and he said, I'm that queer young man from the Midwest. So I think for like young people to feel like their college experience is so accurately represented in a book feels kind of crazy. But also as a parent, I mean, it was hard work to do. I remember after one interview walking up Amsterdam Avenue sobbing. We had a clinician on call while we were doing the research in case the students we interviewed became distraught. But this young woman had a lot of trauma in her background, and she recounted to me being assaulted in ninth grade and then becoming addicted to drugs and being trafficked to support her drug addiction. I mean, this was a really very extreme story. And I said, well, weren't your parents, did no danger signs? And she's like, well, my grades were good and I was playing lacrosse and that's all they cared about. And I mean, I had a kid that same age and it just ended me.
Wow. Seamus, to stay on the topic of parents as an audience for just one second and then segue into responsibility, one of the points that you both make in the book is that, you know, this is really a call to action about prevention. As you say, it's not about adjudication, but It's about prevention. So a lot of that, we have to dial back the chronology and talk about what is going on before students get to a college campus. So what are parents doing right and what are they doing wrong?
So, you know, the story of prevention is, you know, this idea that we spend too much time thinking about what to do after an assault happens and not enough time thinking about how to make it not happen. And we put a lot of pressure on schools, in particular colleges and universities right now. But the research that we're a part of sort of indicates that it's really kind of too late. It's maybe not too late, but we're reaching young people much later than we should. So the survey research that was the part of the research that was led by Claudine Mellons, it found that, you know, one of the strongest predictors for being assaulted in college was being assaulted in high school. And part of the reason, part of the ways in which we explain why assaults happen, there are a variety of reasons. But one reason is the amount of silence and shame that exists around sex and sexuality. And, you know, one young person told us this story about why they got so drunk and had sex. And the explanation was that alcohol was like Novocaine. It helped them numb themselves to do what they thought they shouldn't be doing, in part because there was so much shame and fear around having sex, a sense that you didn't really have the right to have sex. And so, you know, what sexual citizens is an argument that young people should feel like they have the right to say yes and the right to say no to sex, and to recognize that the people they're having sex with have the same set of rights. And we think that parents are often really silent about that right, and that those silences partially explain why people often lose their voice when they find themselves in situations they don't want to be in.
And I want to add on one more point about what parents are doing right, because I feel like we lay a lot on parents in terms of what they're not doing right. We open the sexual assault chapter telling Esme's story, and she was the sort of the classic stranger rape. But in describing it, she said, "Thank God it was me." And what she meant was, thank God I could handle it because I had the money to pay for Plan B, but I could tell my mom because I knew she wouldn't judge me. And so I think that parents who talk to their kids about sex are, maybe they're not protecting them from being assaulted entirely because there's still terrible people out there, but they're letting the kids know that if something happens to them, they can come to them.
But to do a little deeper dive on that, why do you think that is? Do you think it's a generational issue with parents now? Do you think that parents, because sex is something that can be seen physically, it can be seen religiously, it can be seen socially and morally and ethically, that it becomes just too heavy a topic for parents to feel comfortable with? I mean, I know with my teenage patients that I love to have the mom, usually it's the mom, in the room when I first meet the patient, but I recognize that sex can be uncomfortable for even a physician to talk to their teenager about. So what are some of the answers to that?
I mean, the answer is that if you don't talk to your kids about sex, their values are going to be formed by pornography and advertising. So like, what do you really want? Put on your big boy
pants.
There
you go. Right. Thank you for coming. What about...
Sorry to be a little judgy there.
You have three big ideas in the book. It's not, as you said in describing the inception of the book, it's not just about sexual assault. It's also about campus life. But those three ideas are sexual citizenship, sexual projects, and sexual geographies. So, Seamus, why don't you start with sexual geographies and speak to what that means and how important that was a finding in your research?
Sure. So, you know, coming from the tradition, the social science tradition that we come from, we often think about how space really produces interactions or has a huge impact on interactions. So, you know, the way that you all are sitting here right now in this hall, it doesn't quite determine what you can do, but, you know, all the attention is focused on us, for example. That influences what's possible right now. And the space of campus life is really similar. So if you think about a dorm room, for example, and you think about two young people who are hanging out at, say, a bar, and the bar closes, and there's sort of nowhere else to go on campus. Maybe there's a 24-hour library, but there probably isn't. And they go back to a dorm room. What do they confront when they open the door? Usually a desk, a chair, a bureau, and a bed. And if two people are going to sit together, where are they going to sit? They're going to sit on the bed together. And beds have meanings. To sit on a bed, you know, maybe you should be able to do whatever you want when you sit on a bed, which includes having sex, but you should also be able to walk away. But the meanings of beds are sort of laden. And so Jennifer and I began to see all the ways in which not just things like furniture were influencing campus life, but in particular, control over space, and how control over space was really important for explaining power imbalances.
So I mean, that's a perfect segue, Jen, into describe the concept of sexual projects and then how power works its way into that.
So sexual projects is the idea that people have sex for different reasons. And as scientists, it wasn't our job to judge those reasons. As a mom, I judge those reasons. But as a scientist, it's our job to describe those reasons and then to give readers, and in particular our younger readers, an opportunity to reflect on why they have sex.
So I'm going to share a story with you that Jen and Seamus now have heard. Usually one of my kids is in the audience when I tell this story, but unfortunately tonight there is no one here to directly embarrass. But you talk about different reasons. So I, after about 10 years of taking care of this age group of patients as a gynecologist, this is separate and aside from what I do for ABC News, I had this light bulb moment, which I will say is a generalization, so I'm not trying to imply this is true 100% of the time, but I started to think that for most girls, they are conditioned largely by society or their parents to see sex as an emotional currency. That I had heard a lot of parents, moms usually, tell their teenage daughters, I really want you to be in love with someone. I want you to be with a steady boyfriend, partner. This is generally for heterosexual relationships. And it was all about emotions and love. It was this like flowery kind of romantic thing. Whereas for teenage boys, and you have two sons, I have a son, it was kind of the opposite. It was like, this is largely a physical currency. And that if it could be hybridized a little bit and they could meet more in the middle, I thought that that would make for a healthier kind of viewpoint in terms of sex and reasons that people have sex. So when my daughter was 14, I was out jogging with her one day. She went off to boarding school at the age of 14. And I said, I was trying to bring up this idea that girls should have physical pleasure with sex as well. So we were jogging and I said, Chloe, I want to talk to you about vibrators. And she just took off. And even at that age, I couldn't really catch her. But I thought your concept of sexual projects was really, really important because as a parent, we don't often think that there are different reasons that people have sex.
Yeah, and we found actually not maybe quite as stark of a gender binary as you've seen in your practice. There's one story in the book where a young woman has a sort of steady hookup partner who comes to her room. You know, he'll text her. He's like, you up? Which, you know, in those four characters means like, are you awake? Are you in your room? Do you want to have sex? Can I come over? It's very efficient. So they had this sort of ongoing hookup, and she was good with it, and he was good with it. But then his grandmother died, and he was really sad. And she's like, bye. Like, wow. She was in it for sex. Yeah. She was not down for emotion.
Interesting.
So there are women who are really just in it for pleasure and men who, we heard a lot about the men about swan boats and these sort of ideal dates. They really wanted to take a girl on a swan boat. That was like, there wasn't actually that much swan boat action, but there was a lot of swan boat fantasizing.
Seamus, talk about the issue of consent and what you found, which I thought was so interesting, that it's not just consent, yes or no. And also, if you could explain a little bit about how what you found about consent differed in terms of the type of relationships or pairings that you studied.
So right now on college campuses, young people are taught about affirmative consent. And what that means is that the absence of a no doesn't mean that sex is consensual. The person has to convey, both people have to convey that they're consenting to sex. And in some cases, young people are taught that that must be verbal. In many cases, there are all kinds of ways that consent can be conveyed. And the attention to consent is really an attention to what happened in that moment, and was it an assault or was it not an assault? And so part of, you know, we have a kind of an entire chapter on the different ways in which young people make sense of consent. But part of what we want to point to is that, you know, asking, you know, was this sex consensual or not, is really fundamentally a question about adjudication. That is, who can we hold responsible for what happened, and what would a reasonable person do within this kind of context? And for us, we saw consent processes as things that were not just a negotiation between two people in a moment, but instead that had entire social worlds that were brought into that moment. And so friends helped each other interpret what happened after sex had happened. So, you know, young people would go and say, oh, I hooked up with somebody the other night, and they would be like, oh, he's so hot. And so suddenly, like, that really influenced the ways in which people interpreted the sex that happened to be they happened to be having. And we also noted that people had consensual sex, by which we mean they wanted to have sex, without ever verbally consenting in any way, and that we had some examples of people who verbally consented to sex that they didn't want to have, because they did it under duress. And so for us, we sort of push away from this idea of sex as a contract, and instead, you know, part of the point of the idea of sexual citizenship is asking, how is it that you're treating the other person? Are you treating them like someone who said yes, and therefore you know that it's going to be perfectly fine what you're going to do? Or are you treating them like a human being who may have felt like there was a reason they felt forced to say yes? A common thing we heard, particularly among young women in heterosexual contexts, was a story of being in a room somewhere, finding yourself not really wanting to be there, and then, you know, quote, I just gave him a blowjob so I could get out of there. And those encounters are fully consensual in most cases. That is, they're consensual in the sense that the person chooses to perform oral sex in order to sort of complete the encounter and walk out of the room. But in terms of the broader context, we see it as a failure of sexual citizenship, really of the men for not asking what it is that the person they're with really wanted, and for the women in thinking that, like, you know, they've been raised in such a way that they imagine that, like, this is the ways in which they should be acting sexually.
One of the things that I think you do brilliantly in this book and in the work is you really highlight the distinctions or similarities amongst certain groups. And I was particularly searching for, I will admit that I'm reading it semi out of order, which you can do, with another reflection of how amazing the book is. So I picked it up and I went initially searching for the experiences and the findings about LGBTQ students and students of other diverse ethnic backgrounds. So Jen, explain a little bit about what was surprising to you about your findings with LGBTQ students.
Do you want to? So I think one of the things that was confusing to us, for the heterosexual students have a clear script that they learn for how sex should go forward. It feels a little bit like a Jane Austen novel, right? Where, like, it's the man's job to make sex happen and the woman is the blocker, and they get that from media and they get it from romance novels and, you know, all over. So the, like, the Promposal is a perfect example of you know, man making sex happen. And for LGBTQ students, they don't have that script necessarily. And so we found that there were many queer students whose consent practices were actually exactly the way you would want consent to be. Like, they had, for them, that was the first moment of teaching about sex that even felt relevant to them, because whatever sex ed they'd had in school sure wasn't speaking to their experience. So on the one hand, queer consent practices seemed like they should be producing a lot of safety, but on the other hand, we know from our survey and from other surveys that rates of assault are actually much higher.
And Seamus, share, if you will, I know there are several stories, the whole book is stories interwoven on these topics, but there are several compelling stories about queer students and some really pretty horrendous things that they had experienced, and what principles they highlight.
Sure. I mean, that, you know, to continue on the idea of consent, we had one young person who talked to us, and they used the pronoun they, and they were transitioning from, they were born male, but were transitioning to a genderqueer identity, and they didn't want to use their P penis during sex, and their partner was very upset by this and kept pressuring them and pressuring them and pressuring them. And this person, you know, they decided like they would sort of bear this, but every time that they had sex, it felt like their very identity was being invalidated, the identity that they were embracing. And they just didn't have a voice to sort of speak about what they wanted in sex, in part because their gender identity and their sexual identity had been the subject of just so much shame and you know, like everyone around them was sort of either silent or uncomfortable about it. And so, you know, that's one example. But another example was there was a gay man that we spoke to who was from the Midwest and from a fairly sort of conservative background and grew up in a religious family. And to him, you know, being gay was quite difficult given this background, but one of the things that stuck for him was the value of a relationship. And he really, really believed in the value of a relationship. And he told us a story about how his boyfriend came home one night, and in his words, he basically raped me. And what that story was that his boyfriend was pretty forceful about sex and would drink a good bit and would come home and sort of force sex on this young man. And in his own understanding and experience, he sort of said, like, this is just worth tolerating because I don't want to be part of a gay hookup culture. I want to be part of a relationship. This is a value that's super important to me, and that value far supersedes anything else. And I kind of love this guy, and I don't want to get him in trouble. And so we saw this way, the ways in which silences around sexuality, the kind of fear about the character of queer communities often produced additional vulnerabilities for young people.
And Jen, what about the role of alcohol, first on the campus environment in general, and then specifically with respect to sex?
I mean, so there is a lot of sexual shame, and so we heard students talk to us about alcohol. One young woman said, it's like Novocaine before you go to the dentist. I just, you know, I need to be really drunk to feel comfortable hooking up. So I think that, you know, that's a point about alcohol. And another point, I don't want to shock you all, but students don't just drink and then like mistakenly have sex. In fact, they do it on purpose. They drink in order to have sex. And so telling young people you can't consent when you're drunk, and so don't have drunk sex, they hear that as just don't have sex. Like, it's not a message that is effective at all.
And what about the power disparities with respect to alcohol? Because I found that really interesting and surprising and something I had never actually thought of before.
I mean, so much to say about power. I think a big message in the book is that when you think about sexual assault and you think about power, the first thing that you go to is socially organized inequality between men and women. And obviously that's all over the book, but power is complicated and there's lots of different forms of power. So the story of Scott and Lucy, for example, she was a freshman, she had gone to boarding school, she was so excited to like live her college dream. They were out at a bar, orientation week, she and a friend, they met these two seniors, like this was it. And so she and Scott, they stumble up Amsterdam Avenue. He invites her back to his fraternity. She's like, this is just what I've been wanting. But it wasn't just what she had been wanting because, you know, they went into the fraternity and he invited her up to his room and they were making out. And like up until that point, it really was exactly what she wanted. And then he started to take off her pants and she said no. And he said, it's okay. But it wasn't okay because he raped her. And in that moment, so alcohol was part of the power disparity because she was drunker than he was and he was giving her alcohol. But it was also, there was an age disparity and there was a control of space disparity, going back to the sexual geographies that Seamus was talking about. And he was in a building literally surrounded by his friends. So that was an institutional power disparity. So there's so many different power disparities that come together in that moment and that are modifiable. We could talk about that in a moment. You know, and the most charitable thing that we could think about Scott, because remember, we have the story from Lucy's point of view, not from his, is that he didn't understand how powerful he was in that moment. He didn't understand that when he said, no, it's okay, she couldn't just say, no, it's not okay.
And you mentioned Scott and his perspective. You, in fact, go to great lengths to consider the perspective from generally the male assailant. What did you find with respect to that?
Yeah, so we have a chapter on the perspective of people who commit assaults. Some of them are people who recognize or have been found responsible for committing assaults, and some of them are people who do not recognize that they committed assaults, but we sort of pretty clear that they have committed an assault. And this is, you know, part of a perspective of trying to think about these broad relationships in such ways that it's not just that you have some sociopath that is unchangeable because of their sociopathic nature. There may be reasons why they're doing what they're doing. They're not good reasons, but they're reasons that we might be able to address. One young man told us this story. He said, like, I put on a tie, so I knew I was going to have sex. And as the story sort of unfolded, he told us about how this woman had a crush on him for a while. He knew about this. She'd asked him out to a formal, in one of the few instances where women ask men out. He'd agreed to go with her, and she proceeded to get very drunk. He was on an athletic team. He had an early practice the next morning. He wasn't drinking as much. And as he relayed this story to us, he kept telling us about like how annoying it was, like how frustrating the entire evening was because she kept drinking and he just wanted to go home. She was getting really, really drunk and he was not very happy with that. They end up coming back to campus. They'd been partying somewhere off campus and it was pouring rain, and he felt that it would be sort of too rude to sort of push her out of the cab and walk across campus to his own dorm. And she wanted to stay in the cab with him, and so she came back to his room. And then he described to us having sex with her, and he described it as having sex, as she went in and out of consciousness. And he expressed this as kind of his social obligation. Like, this was something that he was obliged to do because he'd put on a tie. I mean, in reality, because he was in this sort of formal moment where she had asked him out, and he was almost in her debt because of this. And sex was the way in which the sort of, like, the debt was repaid. When we saw that story, when we heard this, like, we're horrified by it. We think like there were all sorts of terrible things that happened along the way where his understanding of, you know, her capacity to consent, her sexual citizenship was really, really lacking. But it didn't look like planned predation. It didn't look like something where he sort of, you know, had this entire scheme in mind over the course of the evening. And we began to think about like the failures of communities, of raising this young people, the failures basically of his sexual and human education. And you know, the book is about what it is that we can do to address those kinds of failures.
And what about race? What did you find with respect to different racial groups?
A couple of things. I mean, one thing that was very striking was every single black woman with whom we spoke, every single one had experienced unwanted, non-consensual sexual touching. And so that just really drives home that you can't only think about sexual assault within a gender lens. You have to also think about it within a racial justice lens, and you know, even more broadly, a social justice lens. And we also heard, you know, there's a long history in America of sexual assault and accusations of sexual assault being tied up with racial domination. And we heard from some of the black men students that we interviewed about their fears of being accused of sexual assault. One young man talked about how he didn't like to engage in drunk sex because for him it felt too risky. And in general, black students drink less than white students. And so he talked about one instance in which he'd been with a girl who'd been drinking, and she seemed interested in him, but it didn't feel safe to him. And so they walked around. It was like 2 a.m. He's like, let's just walk around for another 45 minutes. And so they got back to his dorm room, and then they waited a little longer, and then they had sex. But then afterwards, he taped her telling him that he asked her if she had a good time, and he recorded her on his phone. And he said to us, you know, New York is a one-party state, which means that he had done his homework beforehand to know that that recording was admissible in court. So it gave such a piercing sense of the racial precarity that some students of color experience on campus, is underlining that you can't look at the moment of consent without understanding sort of the broader dynamics of campus social life.
So let's get to prevention, which is really your goal. with this entire work and the book. What can people do now, and kind of give it a timeline and a micro and macro level?
So, you know, I mean, breaking the silence on sex, and this really means comprehensive sexuality education, which is not a course that's taught in school, but instead a kind of national project that everyone participates in. You know, in their survey, one of the papers published from it found that young women who had had comprehensive sexuality education that included practicing refusal skills, they were half as likely to experience assault in college. I mean, that's a huge, huge impact. But, you know, the analogy that we often use is with driving, and to say, think about all the effort that we put into making sure that young people know how to drive. We don't just hand them the keys and are like, well, good luck figuring this out. In fact, we do a lot to instruct them along the way. And the instruction that we do doesn't look like our sex ed instruction. It's not about, this is a spark plug, and here's how a spark plug works, right? But that's often how we teach about sex. Like, this is a fallopian tube, and this is right. What a fallopian tube does. It's important to know, but it's actually not that essential for sexual activity. Instead, we talk about, you know, what is a stop sign? But we don't just say, like, okay, you know about stop signs, so you're good to go to drive. No, we talk about, like, you know, what it means to drive at night, how to drive defensively. We even build roads. We create a built environment that's safer for driving. So there are curb cuts to make sure that pedestrians are safe. We have all kinds of policing that happens at particular times of year when we know that people are more at risk to harm one another. Part of the prevention strategy is to ask ourselves, like, what would it look like to do sexuality education in the same way that we do driver's ed?
Just curious, a show of hands from the audience, how many of you know someone who's a current college student now? Wow. So there, look how many lives you just touched. That's amazing. Radically changing the way we teach sexual education. What else, John?
I mean, think as a parent about, you know, from the minute your kids exit your body, if that's how you have them, you are teaching them how to manage their own body. So, and it's a gradual process of separation. Like, there's the moment they learn how to ride the bike, and there's the moment they can pump their legs on the swing. But, you know, you're so involved in your children's bodies, like their teeth every night, brush the teeth, like, did you floss, right? So, like, there's some ways in which we pay a lot of attention to teaching our children what kind of relationship we want them to have with their bodies. But, like, how many parents feel comfortable talking with their kids about masturbation, right? Maybe that's a very high bar, and, like, you all just stop listening when I said that. But, you know, like, it's normal to masturbate. They masturbate in utero. I mean, there's nothing else to do in there, right? You knew that. So,
true.
But then, like, the other message is, like, not in the living room, right? Like, you know, it's not an extracurricular activity. You can't put it on your college application. So, like, messages that are not shaming, that, like, but that are also celebrate, like, you know, it's good to have a body. You should enjoy it. So I think that having some level of comfort oneself around sex, and then trying to convey that to your kids. I mean, I remember, it's one of our former babysitters is in the audience. So she when I mentioned that our older son does sex education in his spare time, she was like, of course, that's a family business. But one of them at some point was listening to us talk about, like, the political scandal du jour. He was 5, and he said, his first comment was, I hope they wore a condom. But then his second comment was, that is gross to have sex with someone you don't love. And so, like, I think that kids listen, right? And so talk. Like, don't protect their little ears. Talk about
sex. So much for
my
theory, by the way. He just threw that out the window. Right. I want to open it up to some audience questions now. And usually we've been doing 2 questions at a time. So first 2 questions.
And if there are students especially,
yes,
we'd love to hear from young
people. We'd love to hear from students first. And there's no such thing as an embarrassing or silly question. It's a judgment-free zone.
So I want to ask, you mentioned about, like, the emotional versus physical relationships that these college students are having. And you said that it's girls and guys, like, either way, in heterosexual relationships, they're both fine with just physical without the emotional. Is it that they're fine with it, or they kind of accepted that that's the norm for their young
adults?
No,
I should qualify that. That was my theory as just a gynecologist. But Jen and Seamus kind of refuted that.
I'm happy to actually talk about that. I don't think it's that it's necessarily what they want, but you know, if we extend part of what we were saying about, you know, what do we convey to young people, the lessons that many of the young people that we spoke to got from their families about sex and dating was, it can come later. Attend to what's really important. What's really important are your grades and getting a good job and making sure you're set up in this like new economy. And this sort of imagination or fascination with, you know, this sort of precarity that they're going to enter into and how relationships were just distracting. So I would say that young people have learned that lesson very well, but they've been taught it. They haven't actually produced it. And, you know, we found very few examples of students at Columbia and Barnard who sort of their family emphasized the importance of relationships and how sex and relationships would be the way in which they connected to some of the people who are the most important to them in their lives, and then they needed to practice it and be attentive to it and be clear about what they wanted from it. Like, instead it was sort of like, yeah, just make sure it doesn't get in the way of your econ grades.
And just again to clarify, my point was that there were big traditional gender inequalities that we tend to, you know, put on girls versus boys from a very early age that I think then has consequences down the road. But that is not in the book.
Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah, hi, thank you. This is really, really fun to listen to, and I can't wait to get into the whole book. So I have a question. You spoke really compellingly about all of the various axes of power that might compound in some cases. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about the police and the criminal justice system as kind of a really important background axis of power that sort of played into that, you know, New York is a one-party state statement, but also that was in the background of the discussion of driving and sort of the institutions that we consider that keep us safe, right? You mentioned that we have extra police in times of the year when we can expect to have, you know, excessive driving, right? So how do the police work into this situation? And are they something that we want to be involved more or less? Or can you talk about some of that paradox?
And just last night, in fact, someone in the audience asked Jennifer and Seamus about mandatory reporting and how that factors into sexual assault, possibly in prevention also, right?
I mean, the model, it depends on what model of policing we're talking about. I mean, we believe in a certain degree of policing, but it's normative policing. So how it is that we treat other people, policing doesn't necessarily mean incarceration. It could mean that what you're trying to do is make sure that we're encouraging the kinds of behaviors that we want to see. You know, Jennifer and I really are sort of pushing against adjudication, but we do present in the book a restorative justice model that we think is really important. And we think that part of the ways in which we should think about addressing assaults after they happen is in reaffirming people's sexual citizenship. That is, for those people who have been harmed, and then thinking about what's required in order to build sexual citizenship within the people who are harmed. And there is a normative commitment to that. It just doesn't necessarily mean that normative commitment is carceral, that we're gonna, you know, imprison people because of this. We're also not lawyers and don't spend a ton of time thinking about that, just as an aside.
Yes. Okay, thank you, first of all, both of you, for this important work. I have a question about this idea of sexual scripts. And I'm wondering if either of you have identified any places where you see positive examples of sexual scripts. In thinking about porn and media, it seems that there are very few places where we see or we read about how to have sex with other people that's focused on pleasure in a meaningful way. It's unrealistic most of the time, and doesn't seem to represent any sense of how people have sex really. So do you have any sense of where, in general, positive sexual scripts exist or come from?
That's a great question. Yeah, let's take one more.
As a preventative or as a as a way to change like cause elements within sexual assaults. I wonder what it would look like for men, or how you might describe it for men, whether there would be, at what point would you hope that progressive sex education could affect a man in a positive way? Because it seems like you would also have to address issues of toxic masculinity at a very young age in order to effectuate it or have it be effectual at adolescence or at a college age. So I wondered how you would imagine it.
So I mean, I'll take that question and then you can take the sexual script. So, I mean, there is really good evidence both conceptually and empirically that sex education, good, comprehensive, age-appropriate sex education that starts in kindergarten can prevent sexual assault, can actually reduce perpetration. So, which means perpetration both by men and by women and by people of any gender. So yes, like this is something that we could do. Right now, New York State, today was statewide day of advocacy for sex education. So I think, and there's actually, across the country, there's a ton of support for sex education among parents on both sides of the aisle. So it's really just that the policymakers have failed us. Not that, we know that sex education can do this, and we just haven't gotten it done.
Okay,
and layered onto this is this idea of power inequality, that, you know, part of, you know, addressing, say, toxic masculinity or something like that is addressing power inequalities. In terms of the sexual scripts idea, like what is a positive message for this, you know, we're somewhat critical of pornography in the book, but not very critical of pornography, in large part because you sort of say, why is it that pornography is so, you know, has such a large influence on young people? Because we've abdicated our responsibility to actually provide sexuality education. And insofar as we haven't done that, the information's coming from somewhere else. And, you know, as Jennifer said so many times, it's from porn and advertising. And so, you know, one way to think about this is like, could we construct more sex positive porn? And there have been people who have tried to do that. But I think, you know, if we build upon what Jennifer just said of starting young and, you know, looking at instances where partners affirm one another, where they're actually supportive of one another, and we point that out to young people and we sort of celebrate those instances. You know, part of the idea here in placing sex within a broader matrix of social relationships, so in saying that like sex is a social behavior, it's not a health behavior, is to say that like there are lots of things that we can do in terms of creating the conditions of basic respect and recognition of other persons that have nothing to do with sex that could actually have big impacts on the ways in which people act sexually.
I had a question regarding, you know, the transferability of this study. I gather you mostly interviewed and observed at Barnard and Columbia, and I'm wondering, you know, in what ways do you think that campus is you know, universal, if for lack of a better word, and what ways in which it might, you know, differ from a more rural campus or a smaller one or a one that's maybe not 4 years or not as selective.
Just building on that, what can we do as university faculty to help?
So, you know, the study is very specific to a place, and part of the argument is that place really matters. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of particularities to the stories that we tell that are conditional on like being at a super elite campus. So most college students go to universities where the acceptance rate is well above 50%. Most college students go to universities that are not residential. Most college students go to places that look nothing like Columbia. In terms of the particular things, it may not be, you know, representative of a broader experience. But we think the analytic tools, that is the three main concepts, can be useful. So that the idea of a sexual project, what is sex for, and communities constructing sexual projects, doesn't really matter whether or not you're a college student or, you know, 85 years old. Thinking about what your sexual project is, what you want out of sex, is a useful thing. Thinking about building sexual citizenship and thinking about the power inequalities within space, we think analytically can be deployed to explain the different kinds of experiences that people are having, and we hope that people will sort of, you know, instead of taking all these stories as like representative of the world, they'll take the framework that we give and apply it to their specific contexts.
I think that there are a lot of things that faculty can do. I think that there's the way that we shape the experience in the classroom, and then there's, you know, the things that we can do in the campus context. So both in the classroom and outside, I think that throwing down as hard as we can to support diversity is really, really important. One of the reactions that Columbia has had to our research that I'm most excited about is the ways in which they've invested in housing for underrepresented, so special, not just housing, but sort of dedicated social spaces. So the lounge for queer students was moved out of the basement, like it was in this awful basement space, and now there's a much better space, and the Black Students Organization got a better space, and there's better space for Latinx students. And I think that to the extent that there are social spaces on campus that different groups who are not powerful white men can socialize in the ways that they want, and it doesn't mean that in a space where they don't mix with other kinds of students, but I think that, again, like the main modifiable social factor on campus is social space. And so trying to drive that social, the allocation of social space in a way that is sensitive to and supportive of diversity, to my mind, that's part of undoing the structures of vulnerability. And then, I mean, it depends what subject you teach, but I think that questions about gender and power figure everywhere, right? They figure very prominently in the Columbia core curriculum. And so I think ways that our colleagues at Columbia have tried to question many different social hierarchies in the classroom and to make, I mean, the students come to school to learn, right? And so making that learning about critical thinking, about power, is part of providing them with the tools that they need to navigate these social worlds more safely.
Hi, thank you so much. I work currently with college students and found this very interesting, and will continue to find it very interesting as different issues come up. I'm really interested in the idea of sexual projects and how people come to make meaning of consent in their own peer groups. And I think particularly with elite institutions, those tend to be elite groups that are hard to get into, that are very coveted. Could you talk a bit more about your work in looking at some of those groups like fraternities, like athletic teams, and how those sort of higher echelon groups really influence how people kind of come to understand their experiences? Thank you.
So my question specifically also kind of relates to the entire conversation. So we have touched on how LGBTQ folks generally experience higher rates of sexual violence and intimate partner violence. We also know that the CDC has said that adherence to rigid gender roles is a risk factor for the perpetration of sexual violence. We've also talked about the lack of relationship scripts that are available to queer and gender nonconforming students, which in my own work can also allow for like the creation of new relationship possibilities, which is exciting to me. So I guess I'm wondering, in your research, if you found with any of the queer and gender nonconforming folks that you interviewed, whether there was any sort of like strengths-based outcomes of queer and gender nonconforming relationships.
Okay, last question, I guess. I'm wondering if in any of this research, I haven't read the book and I haven't read the study, so I'll say that up front. I was wondering if you examined the role of teaching self-worth as a very fundamental, essential part of any comprehensive sex ed program. Because I'm a sex educator, I teach at Temple. I feel like you almost don't have to say the word consent or teach explicitly or directly about it if you are teaching your students that they are worthy of more than just drunk sex or less than pleasurable sex, or I'll give you a blowjob at the end of the night to get out of here sex, or non-intimate sex, or superficial sex. So what is your observation or understanding of the role of self-worth in reducing sexual violence?
Okay.
I'm gonna take the LGBTQ. You know, the terrible thing about interacting with academics is that the answer that we always give is like, well, it's complicated. and part of the answer really is that it's complicated because when we look at the LGBTQ plus community, it's like not actually a community, and there are huge differences. There are probably bigger differences within the group than there are between the group and other groups. So, and I think the other challenge for this study is that its focus was not, we were very, very conscious to integrate the stories of LGBTQ students with everyone else. So there's no chapter on, you know, queer youth. It's sort of like every story that we tell, you know, every sort of fourth one is probably a story of a queer person. And I think, like, there's really, I would be excited, there's space for the kind of work that you're doing, because since we didn't particularly target gender nonconforming students, I think we have like five of them in the interviews. And so I don't feel comfortable making large scale generalizations, but I hope the work is helpful for you to sort of build off, respond to, maybe even critique in order to answer that sort of the strength of relationship question that you raised.
And in terms of peer groups and sort of elite the elite subpopulations, I mean, we found both for sports teams and for Greek life that there's as much diversity across them in terms of social prestige. So like there's the really elite fraternity where like everybody wants to get with guys from that fraternity, and then there's the fraternity that is referred to by students as rapey, and that's sort of like a moniker of being low prestige. But certainly among those higher prestige fraternities, there's a way in which they exert a lot of social power, because it is hard for the men in those groups to perceive themselves as not desirable. And it's hard for people to define sex with them as not desirable, because having sex with them does confer certain kind of bragging rights. So you see an enormous social power, which I think it's really important to distinguish. We're not saying that the people in those fraternities are bad people. We're saying that there's a power of being in those social groups that they may be unaware of. And so they need to, I will say this, learn to check themselves when they interact with other people, because they may not understand the power that they wield in interpersonal interactions. In terms of self-worth, 1,000 times yes. That, like, obviously, feeling like you deserve whatever kind of sexual project you want is part of it. We found so many students who weren't even clear about what their sexual project was. So they didn't have, they weren't at the point of thinking, like, do I deserve this or not? Because literally, they hadn't even begun to think, like, how do I feel about having sex for status? Or am I really good with hooking up? Or actually, like, am I longing for a relationship?
So in closing, this is the part where I get to slightly embarrass them. This is not a question. This is more between us. I want to really thank all of you for coming out and spending this kind of time, which is so, so important. I think as a mom, as a doctor, as a member of the media, generally in that order, by the way, that the best bang for the buck, we learn the most when we're comfortable having uncomfortable conversations, and sometimes those conversations don't mean having all the answers. And I think you raise incredible questions in this book. You've raised incredible questions here tonight. This book, I guarantee, will save lives. And from a medical doctor to social scientist doctors, I want to thank you for writing it, and thank you all for coming. And now we'll have the book signing to follow.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.